The Word was made flesh. Chapter 22. The increasing tension something has to give. In the 1970s, the Seventh-day Adventist Church found itself facing a theological challenge, created by the insistent and aggressive teaching of certain Bible teachers and ministers that it is not possible for Christians, by themselves or with divine assistance, to stop sinning. It followed, as they saw it, that justification, i.e. forgiveness, was the hope of salvation, since sin would continue in the Christian life until it was miraculously removed by divine power at the moment of entry into the heavenly kingdom. Justification was seen as an act of God for the benefit of man, in which man himself had no part. This Calvinistic teaching was accepted by some and rejected by others. The tension increased until, at the celebrated Glacier View Conference in Colorado in 1979, church leaders rejected the teaching, according to some reports, or more or less bypassed it while defending the doctrine of the sanctuary, according to other reports. In any case, there is a significant number of Seventh-day Adventist ministers today who are concerned, and who feel ill at ease over the whole situation. They are suffering from the tension of being asked to embrace two propositions that are mutually exclusive. 1. Christ came to the earth in the human nature of the unfallen Adam. He was therefore exempt from all those weaknesses, tendencies, hereditary handicaps, etc., with which we must contend in order to live without sinning. 2. Nevertheless, he was tempted in all things as we are, and has given us an example that we should imitate by living without sin as he did. The glaring contradiction in these two incompatible propositions may best be seen by examining a description of the handicaps that we have, according to this view, and that Christ did not have. The description of man. This state of sin into which all men are born is an inherited disposition to sin. The act of sin springs from this disposition. Actual sinning on man's part is the natural expression of this alienation. We come into the world a depraved species. As concerning all other men, except Christ, they are born without God. The specific condition to which Adam brought all men is original sin. Ours is a fallen nature. This fallenness involves all our desires and susceptibilities. The description of Christ, the connection of all other men with Adam, has produced in them a fallen, human nature with tendencies to sin. Christ is the one exception. His desires, inclinations, and responses were spontaneously and instantly positive to righteousness and automatically negative towards sin. There was nothing in him that responded to sin. To thus describe man, in contrast with Christ, and yet to maintain that Christ had no advantage over us is manifestly ridiculous. What one of us would not gladly trade his nature for a nature that is spontaneously and instantly positive to righteousness and automatically negative towards sin? To maintain that a person with such a nature was tempted in all things as we are is preposterous. Something has to give. Either the view that Christ came to earth in the human nature of the unfallen Adam must be held together with its logical corollary, that he was so different from us that we cannot be expected to overcome as he overcame, or the view that Christ came to earth in the human nature of fallen man must be held together with its logical corollary, that we can, by using the same methods that he used, faith, trust, God dependency, overcome as he overcame. To intermingle these two views is to set up a tension in logic that will, sooner or later, become unbearable. Glacier View has by no means solved the problem. As long as our seminary and our colleges continue to teach that Christ came to the earth in the human nature of the unfallen Adam, we will continue to see an increasing number of our ministers and members abandon the historic faith of the Adventist Church and embrace the doctrine of modern Calvinism, that it is not possible, by any means, for man to overcome. We must in fairness recognize that historic Calvinism was somewhat different from modern Calvinism in its teaching on this point. In the famous Westminster Confession of 1647, a statement of faith that is widely regarded as being the most comprehensive and valuable of the early Calvinistic confessions, and from which large portions have been carried over into other creeds, there is a section on the law of God in which we read, 7. Either are the forementioned uses of the law contrary to the grace of the gospel, but do sweetly comply with it. The Spirit of Christ subduing and enabling the will of man to do that freely and cheerfully which the will of God, revealed in the law, requires to be done. However, modifications of this view appeared early in the post-Reformation years, and were the occasion of much disagreement between Protestants. Arminius of Holland was among the first prominent opponents of the justification-only theology of the modified Calvinism, hence the term Arminian theology, which is used by scholars to describe the school of thought that stood over against Calvinistic theology. To adequately discuss the differing opinions of the two theological schools would require another volume at least as large as this one, but perhaps a brief outline would be helpful. The Calvinistic school of thought looks back to Augustine for some of its major presuppositions, and to Calvin and Luther in Reformation times. It must be remembered that Luther was as firmly committed to the doctrine of predestination as Calvin was, although the name of Calvin is more commonly associated with that doctrine in our time. The Calvinistic school has been represented since Reformation times, generally speaking, by the Anglican, Reformed, Presbyterian, some Congregational, and some Baptist churches. In our time, probably most of those Christians who call themselves evangelicals would prefer to be thought of as Calvinistic in their theology, rather than Arminian. The Arminian school looks back to the Anabaptists for many of its presuppositions, and to Erasmus, Zwingli, and Arminius in Reformation times. Since then it has been represented by the Methodists, some Congregational, and some Baptist churches, and by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The outline that follows is necessarily oversimplified, for the sake of brevity, and does not describe the nuances of difference within schools of thought, such as the various concepts of predestination among Calvinists, or of sanctification among Arminians, but is a rough and general classification. General features of Calvinistic theology. Absolute predestination. Original sin defined as inherited guilt and weakness. Man does not have free will. Christ came in nature of unfallen Adam. Emphasis on Christ as our substitute. Man cannot stop sinning by any means. Justification only saves man. Sanctification as fruit of justification is nice but not necessary to salvation. Instant sanctification occurs when Christ comes. General features of Arminian theology. Conditional predestination. Original sin defined as inherited weakness only. Man does have free will. Christ came in nature of fallen man. Emphasis on Christ as our example and substitute. Man can stop sinning through the power of Christ. Justification only does not save man. Sanctification as fruit of justification is necessary to salvation. Instant sanctification does not occur at any time. Each of these two theological systems must be credited with internal logical consistency, which is to say that the propositions within each system are logically compatible with the basic presuppositions of that system. But it would be exceedingly difficult to reach within either system to pull out an isolated doctrine and fit it into the other system. To do so would be to set up all kinds of problems of logical inconsistency and contradiction. Yet this is what a number of Seventh-day Adventists are trying to do at the present time. Attracted by the pleasing possibility of gaining a better acceptance from evangelical churches, or by the alluring concept of salvation in sin, they have attempted to take proposition number 4, that Christ came to the earth in the nature of the unfallen Adam, out of the Calvinistic system and fitted into the Seventh-day Adventist, Arminian, system. The results have ranged from confusion to chaos. In the limited space that we may here give to this subject, let us compare the two. Bottom lines. Calvinist Evangelical 8. Instant sanctification occurs when Christ comes, Arminian Adventist 8. Instant sanctification does not occur at any time. It is apparent that the method by which instant sanctification might occur would have to be manipulation, that is, something mechanical or physical, bypassing human weakness and human will. If a man has been sinning up to a certain point in time, and if at that point in time God does something to him that immediately makes him so that he will never sin again, that could not be called either justification or sanctification. The proper term would be manipulation, a process, shall we say, in which God takes the celestial screwdriver from his heavenly tool chest, inserts it into the ear of the believer, and makes an adjustment, saying, "There, my beloved, you will never sin again." This screwdriver salvation might not be offensive to the Calvinist, who believes that man has no free will in any case, so that all of his experiences in salvation are predetermined by the will of God, which simply overrides man's will, and could be classified as manipulation. But how could this screwdriver salvation be combined with the free will principle of Arminian Adventist theology? According to Ellen White, such a combination of ideas is impossible. When Christ shall come, he will not change the character of any individual. When he comes, he is not to cleanse us of our sins, to remove from us the defects of our characters, or to cure us of the infirmities of our tempers and dispositions. If wrought for us at all, the work will be accomplished before that time. When the Lord comes, those who are holy will be holy still. Those who have preserved their bodies and spirits in holiness, in sanctification, and honor will then receive the finishing touch of immortality. But those who are unjust, unsanctified, and filthy will remain so forever. No work will then be done for them to remove their defects and give them holy characters. The refiner does not then sit to pursue his refining process and remove their sins and corruption. This is all to be done in these hours of probation. It is now that this work is to be accomplished for us. Ellen White consistently and clearly identifies the idea that God has given a law that his creatures cannot obey, even through his grace, as the first and biggest lie told about God by Satan. It is astonishing and disheartening to listen to Seventh-day Adventist theologians, as I have done, assuring Seventh-day Adventist congregations that they firmly believe that the writings of Ellen White are inspired by God, and they firmly believe that it is impossible for man to stop sinning, even through the power of God. One of them even goes so far as to suggest that it is God's will that his people continue sinning, so that he may continue to graciously forgive them. Yet this is the condition in which we presently find ourselves. It is my conviction that this is the natural fruit of the tree that was planted by the publication of the inaccurate Christological statement in Questions on Doctrine, in 1957. I strongly suspect that Ellen White, who did, after all, have a saving sense of humor, might have surveyed all of these endeavors of her interpreters, and reflected, with friends like these, who needs enemies?